Today at Reader's Corner, Elizabeth Letts, author of The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. During the final days of World War II, a group of American soldiers encountered a German spy carrying nothing but photos of beautiful white horses. The story behind those photos was even more surprising. Nearby, on a farm behind enemy lines, the Nazis had stockpiled some of the world's most valuable horses as part of an ambitious breeding program to develop the perfect warhorse. But with the Russian army fast approaching from the east and the Third Reich on the verge of defeat, these precious animals were now in great danger. The German spy had an audacious request. Would the Americans step forward to save them? Elizabeth Letts tells this amazing story in The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. The book is nonfiction, but it has many plot twists and turns, almost as many as you'd find in any spy thriller. Ms. Letts is a lifelong equestrian herself. Her previous books include the bestseller, The $80 Champion, and two novels. Ms. Letts joins us today by phone for this interview. Elizabeth Letts, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, as I just told you before we got on the air here, I thought your book is just one of the finest written nonfiction pieces I've seen in a long time. It reads like a novel, and I don't just mean all the twists and turns, but I mean how beautifully written it is. And I must say, I didn't realize it until I found your book, The Perfect Horse, that I had read The $80 Champion. That is a great tale as well. So you're on quite a run here. Let's talk about this one, though. This is so exciting. First of all, help us with these stallions, the several breeds of horses that are the stars of the show here.
Well, the story, in order to understand the story of why this happened and why we conducted a rescue of horses at the end of World War II, you have to understand that there was this centuries-old tradition in Europe of breeding fine horses. And in my book in particular, there are two groups of horses that come into play. The most important one was the White Lipizzaner of Austria. These are horses that were bred by the Austro-Hungarian Empire for centuries. They're pure white, and they are bred to perform specific, very complicated dressage movements that were originally developed in antiquity for cavalry horses. They are some of the most purebred horses in the world. They're also some of the most rare. So at the beginning of World War II, there were only about 3,000 purebred Lipizzaner in the entire world. The other group of horses that I talk about in the book were Arabians that were bred in Poland, originally imported from the Arabian Peninsula, but refined in Poland, bred by princes, some of the most beautiful and finely tuned horses in the world. These two groups of horses became the prize possessions of the German Reich during World War II. They were seized and brought together to breed a perfect horse.
And that's where I was going next, is that in a sense the Nazis took this idea of selective breeding to new heights, because it starts to sound very much like the eugenics that they used in other more horrible circumstances.
Yeah, this was really, to be honest with you, the most surprising and astonishing thing for me when I started to do my research into the subject. And I didn't see where there would be a parallel between eugenics as applies to human selective breeding, which was the Third Reich's philosophy that they, you know, their horrible philosophy that they used during the Third Reich to exterminate disabled people, of course, Jews and homosexuals and all kinds of different people. And I didn't see the connection, that there would be a connection between horse breeding. But as I was doing my research, what I discovered was that horse breeding was really one of the places where we developed an understanding of how to do selective breeding before we understood the science behind it. So people have been breeding horses, bigger horses, faster horses, heavier horses. They bred horses who would eat less, which was good for the cavalry, that could pull heavier loads, that could go longer distances, et cetera. We had really developed a lot of science that was out in front of when we discovered DNA and found out how that actually worked. So the horse breeders had this knowledge and wrote these books about breeding. And people started to think, and this is in the late 19th and early 20th century, well, why can't, if you can breed better horses, why can't you breed better people? And so that's where the link came in. The Germans took some of the theories that had been written about innocently enough in breeding livestock and applied them, started to apply them to humankind. And I should add that it wasn't just the Germans. These ideas were very much in vogue in the United States and in England earlier in the 20th century, but they were really applied with disastrous consequences in Nazi Germany.
I mentioned in the intro that the Russians were fast approaching and the Germans were concerned about this. Obviously, there were among the Nazis some real horse lovers who were concerned about this, and that's the reason why the Americans were contacted by the Germans. But help us understand why the Germans didn't trust the Russians as the Russians were moving westward. They were obviously concerned that the Russians didn't have the same interest in prize stallions that they did.
Sure. So to set the scene for you, this is the very, very last days of World War II. We're just about 2 weeks before the end of the war. The Americans have advanced all the way up, all the way through Germany, and they are holding on the border of Czechoslovakia. The Third Army, not allowed to move any further. Meanwhile, the Russians are moving in very rapidly from the east. And at some point, these two armies, the two largest armies ever assembled, are going to meet somewhere in the middle, but nobody knows exactly where that's going to be. The horses, the prize stallions, had been secreted away by the Germans in an area of Czechoslovakia that was called the Bohemian Bastion. It was considered the least likely to be invaded from east or west. And in fact, this is true. Even at the very, very end of the war, neither of the armies have come through there yet, but they're going to. And so the Germans who were in charge of the stud farm, they were horsemen. They wore the German uniforms. They were military officers. But first and foremost, they were horsemen, and they considered first and foremost their duty to be to care for these horses and to keep them safe. And so they were stuck in a terrible dilemma. They didn't know what to do. They were afraid that if the Russian army came through, that the Russians were not thinking about horses in particular, except that they were slaughtering livestock to feed their troops. And so there was a feeling that if the Russians came through, they might just indiscriminately kill the horses. On the other hand, the Germans had sworn an oath of loyalty to the Führer, and the idea that they would somehow turn to the Americans was very, very unlikely indeed. And in fact, there are very few instances in World War II where the Germans and they did actually turn to the Americans in this manner. So the Germans have heard that the Russians are just about to come through this horse farm and fear that they will slaughter the horses. And so what do they do? Do they trust the Russians? Do they try to reach out to the Americans, which is treason? And Berlin was telling them to stay and fight. And they had no guns. They weren't armed as soldiers. And they didn't want to lose the horses. And so that's where they found themselves on about April 25th, 1945.
So the Spanish writing school fits into this. And I know in your book you referred to the Spanish writing school as a lifelong fascination of yours. Perhaps you could describe for us just the history of the Spanish writing school, and then where is it today?
Sure. Well, the Spanish writing school, the first thing is it confuses people because it's called the Spanish writing school, but it's located in Vienna, Austria. And the reason for this is that originally the horses trained at the Spanish writing school in Austria were of Spanish origin. The Spanish writing school is still there today, and it is a truly beautiful and remarkable Baroque building. It was designed to be an indoor riding hall where these pure white horses that I talked about originally, the Lipizzaner, were trained to perform these very, very unusual and highly coordinated maneuvers. It really looks like horse dancing. They dance, they leap in the air, they do quadrilles. It's very beautiful. And the performances were put on only for, you had to be either invited by the monarchs of the Habsburg Empire or you couldn't even go there. And so this institution was about 400 or 500 years old by the time World War II started. And during the war, when Austria was occupied by Germany, it was very shaky whether the Spanish riding school was going to be able to continue. There was a very courageous Austrian by the name of Alois Podaisky who was put in charge of the Spanish riding school and had a great and very profound love for these horses. And he knew how rare they were. And he knew that this Spanish riding school was the only place left in the world where this very specific equestrian art was being practiced. So if the Spanish riding school ceased to be, this entire centuries-old tradition would also cease to be. And so he was fighting to keep the Spanish riding school intact and to protect the Lippitz Honor horses who were there at the school. So you had the horses that were trained to perform who were there at the school. Almost all of the rest of these 3,000 horses were hidden away at this stud farm in Czechoslovakia. So we have kind of two different places where this breed is very much in peril.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Elizabeth Letts, author of The Perfect Horse, The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis. So when you talk about the dances, the performances that these horses do, is that called dressage in America or wherever?
Yes. So the reason that it's so specialized is that it is called classical dressage. So dressage is one of the equestrian sports. It's very popular in the United States. It's an Olympic sport, and it involves doing prescribed movements with a horse that looks a lot like horse dancing, and the horses have to be trained for a long period of time and highly skilled riders. So in that form, it exists in the United States. But classical dressage that's performed at the Spanish Riding School is somewhat different because they actually use the same principles that were brought down from antiquity that had been the kind of training methods and the movements that were used for many, many hundreds of years. And in particular, the Lippitz Honor at the Spanish Riding School do movements that are called airs above the ground. And the airs above the ground are generally not practiced in any other place, but these are places where they train horses to leap up into the air in various ways and to do poses with a rider on them that are really, really difficult. It'll take 10 to 12 years to train a horse to do a movement like that. And the expertise, the way that they train the horses, is something that has been passed down from master to master through the years in a word-of-mouth tradition in the Spanish riding school. But if you want to see something that would be similar to that, but not quite exactly the same, that would be the sport of dressage.
Well, this reminds me of the role that General George Patton plays in this interesting tale, because, of course, he is given a demonstration of this horse, and I wonder if you could help us understand better Patton's role here. First of all, he had something to do with having to approve this very risky mission of going behind enemy lines to get these horses. And then secondly, he is actually treated to a performance.
Yes. Well, George Patton, as many of our great World War II army leaders, was a cavalryman, and he was a passionate horseman. And in particular, he was a passionate polo player. And Patton believed that horses and horseback training were very important for soldiers because it was the best way, especially polo, to train them for combat during peacetime. So Patton was an interesting guy because he was a big proponent of tanks and of the mechanization of the army and the move away from using horses. But he was also a very passionate proponent of horses. As it happened, the man on the ground, the 2nd Cavalry officer by the name of Colonel Hank Reed, who was the man who was closest to the Lippitz Honor and the hidden horses at the time at the end of the war, was an old friend of George Patton. They were both polo players. So Hank Reed and George Patton knew each other through the polo community. So when Hank Reed realized that there was this opportunity to go in behind enemy lines into Czechoslovakia when they were not allowed to go that far and get the horses, it turned out that the person who had to give him permission was a passionate horseman as well, George Patton. And I really truly believe that had not it been for that really unlikely coincidence that you had these two men who both knew why this was so important and who both really had been inculcated in the cavalry code of honor, which is to save the horse first, that was a coincidence without which I think that the horses would never have made it through the war. So Reed calls Patton, and Patton says, you can go get him, But if anything happens, I'm going to tell them that it was just some dumb cavalryman who got lost behind enemy lines.
I noticed that right away. I thought, oh boy, Patton, we may have given permission, but he wasn't going to take any responsibility for it.
Exactly. So as it happens, and as I mentioned, so we've got the Lipizzaner honor in two places. We've got the mares and the foals are hidden on a farm in Czechoslovakia, but the stallions, who were performers in the Spanish riding school, had been evacuated into Upper Austria. And just after the end of the war, Alois Podaisky has the stallions at this castle in Upper Austria, and he's worried that nobody's going to care about them or understand or worry at all about whether it's worth. I mean, you have to remember that there wasn't enough food to feed people at the end of the war in Germany and Austria. Would you spare hay and stabling and everything for these horses? Would anyone care? Well, as it happens, one of the officers who was in the location where the stallions were, again, another horseman, and he said, you know, my boss, George Patton, really loves horses. Let's get him down here, and you can put on a performance for him. And when you put on this performance, you may be able to win him over to your cause. And so, indeed, that's what happened. Just a few days after the end of the war, Alois Podaisky got his performing stallions, and they put on a performance in this area where they had been evacuated for Patton and some of the army top brass. And it was at that point that Patton said, I'm going to put the Spanish riding school under the protection of the American government during the post-war period. So that was pretty amazing that that happened.
Well, it's even more amazing, not just that Patton and Hank Reed were horse lovers, but if there's a Paul Revere to your story, it's Tom Stewart, another American soldier. And why don't you help us understand the role that he plays, where he comes from, and again, a horse lover, a guy who really understands horses, and only a guy like this could probably pull off something like he did.
That's right. So now Hank Reed has gotten permission to send some soldiers over to try to get the horses out. The Germans have sent an emissary to them, riding two white stallions. He brings one for himself and one that he can use to give somebody a ride. And he's going to take them back to try to negotiate the surrender of the horse farm so that they can take it over without fighting. And so Hank Reed's got to pick somebody. And that somebody is going to have to mount up on this horse with this German soldier that he just met 5 minutes ago, trust him to take him over the mountains and through the woods, because this is the Bohemian forest here, ride all the way through the night, arrive at this German horse farm, negotiate with the German commander who's in charge of the farm, and secure its release. And of course, again, you know, how do you really know? They were taking it on trust that this man was really going to take care of this officer. So the person who was chosen was a young man, a captain by the name of Tom Stewart, who was actually the son of a U.S. senator from Tennessee. And he had grown up on a farm in Tennessee, and Tom Stewart had always ridden, actually, Tennessee walking horses. He loved animals. He was kind of a quiet guy, very, actually, devout, and his nickname was the Little Minister. And Hank Reed thought to himself, well, this Tom Stewart, this is someone that I can trust. And also, he knows his way around a horse. I can put him on horseback, and I can send him out to ride over there. And so that's what happened. Tom Stewart mounted up on one of a pair of white Lipizzaner, accompanied by one of the German officers from the horse farm. And they rode through the forest past snipers, past barbed wire and all kinds of things to arrive at the horse farm to try to negotiate the surrender. And if you read the book, and I really don't want to go into all of it, it's really quite astonishing what happens once Tom Stewart gets across enemy lines. It's sometimes you just can't make this up. It's really worthy of a spy thriller.
That's right.
But that was Tom Stewart. He, you know, he was the right man for the job. He was a very humble fellow, which I think is really typical of World War II veterans. I didn't meet him myself because he was already gone. But I was able to interview his sister, who was, she was, I think, at the time that I interviewed her, 98 years old. And she was able to fill in some of his character, and he never really wanted to take credit for what he had done, didn't talk about it all that much, until finally he allowed the Austrian government to celebrate him at a Lipizzaner performance when he was in his 90s. So I thought that he was quite a remarkable guy, and the son of a U.S. senator who was not afraid to, you know, really do his duty like that.
This is Bob Custer, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Letts about her book, The Perfect Horse, the true story of a daring rescue behind enemy lines in the closing days of World War II. Clearly, this book is not just about horses. It's about the greatest generation and the people who made such a difference in this one case, but it's, of course, thousands of stories like this. There's one touching moment at the very end of your book where you mention a soldier who is killed in the middle of this tale, James Harold Pittman, and talk about a guy that really risked his life for his country. Tell us his story and how it fits into this tale of the horses.
Well, I think when you write a book about World War II, it is nothing if not humbling, because again and again, you come across the stories of these people who, when they are asked to do their duty, they do it. And even if it means at the cost of their life, with never a word of complaint. And so when I was reading about Pittman, I found out that he was an officer, and I was reading his story, and I knew that there was a big battle as the 2nd Cavalry was traversing across France. The biggest battle that they fought was the Battle of Luneville in France, and they were able to hold this village under very, very difficult circumstances. And so I was trying to find some information about this fellow Pittman, who I knew had been a very important player in this big battle. And I was having a hard time finding him, and I finally found somebody. I contacted him, and he said that he was James Pittman's son. And Pittman was killed in battle, and his son was only 18 months old at the time that he was killed. So what really was very, I think, meaningful to me was that his son said to me, "I really hope that you will be able to bring him alive for me, because I never knew him, and I know the circumstances of his service and his death, but I really feel like I would like to know him better as a person." And that was very meaningful to me as an author, and I kept that in mind throughout the time that I was writing the book, that nobody would know these people's names. Nobody would really remember what they did. And I think it's really important, as you said, to point out that my story is just one of many stories. We feel like we know all the stories out of World War II, but we don't. And these men who were so brave, at the same time, they simply were very, very humble to a man. They gave even as much as their lives without ever, you know, really complaining or anything. And it's very remarkable.
So we have Tom Stewart trying to get these horses out. How many horses were moved to safety? How long was the journey? How many miles?
There were about 350-odd horses who were moved to safety. What was really remarkable was that it was foaling season. And I mentioned that a lot of these were mares, and so their foals were sometimes just days old. Some of the mares were just about to give birth. The ones that were too fragile to walk because they were either just about to give birth or had just given birth were loaded onto improvised trucks. They used snow fences on flatbed trucks, and they loaded the horses up. This is not how you would normally transport purebred horses or mares or foals. And those were driven, but the rest of them, there was no way to move them except by herding them the way you would herd, you know, cattle across Texas. And fortunately, because these were American soldiers, there were a number who had been cavalrymen and had been trained to ride. And then there were some who were just, you know, from the West, and they had done it. They had grown up on farms and they knew. And so those were put in charge of moving the horses, and they herded them from Czechoslovakia into Germany. And I don't remember right now how many miles it was, but I want to say it must have been about 50. So it was close, but not so, so close. It took them a couple of days to do it.
Well, these horses are now safely in American hands, but they're still in Europe. And now we have to decide what to do with them. What happens next?
This was really the you know, kind of the hardest part of the book for me to write. We took control of these horses, and we were able to get them to safety. And we were able to repatriate the 219 or 220 Lipizzaner who had come from Austria. that the Americans had also rescued a number of other horses, that it was much less clear what should happen to them. You can imagine a horse is not like a painting, where a painting can change hands a number of times and everybody is still sure that it's the same painting. But if you're talking about a horse, maybe a horse that belonged from one country was bred to a horse from another country and has now produced a foal. Or maybe the horse has come along, but the pedigree hasn't come along with it. And so here are these beautiful purebred horses, and they now belong to the American Army. And as you can imagine, right after the end of World War II, this was not the American Army had an awful lot on their hands, including a gigantic number of human refugees to deal with. And there was not enough food and obviously all kinds of infrastructure problems. So now what to do with the horses? So they send the Austrian Lipizzaner back to Austria, which was a great triumph. But there's still about 100 horses left. And they didn't really know what to do. There was quite a bit of wrangling, and it was hard to take care of them because there were food shortages and it was difficult to find a place to put them. So eventually, one of the horse cavalry proponents from the United States gets permission to take some of the horses, ship some of the horses back to the United States. And this is part of the story where you think, you know, nonfiction is just sometimes so much more astonishing than fiction, because they put them on a ship and sailed them back to the United States. However, they ran into a giant storm on the way back.
And they almost didn't, all of them almost didn't make it, but in the end, I guess they were okay.
They were, yes, but it was quite dramatic what they had to do to get those horses across from Europe.
Let's close with the story of one horse. If you could tell us, is it Vitez? Is that
Vitez,
how you?
Yeah.
Vitez was one of the stallions that made it across the Atlantic back into America, far away from his native Poland. What happens to Vitez down the road?
That was really a remarkable story. Vitez is an Arabian. He was born in Poland. One of the prides of Poland at the time that he was born. Beautiful, beautiful horse. He was a dark bay with a white star and four white stockings, you know, on his legs. Just very flashy, very beautiful. And he was taken by the Germans in this perfect horse breeding project and rescued by the Americans. And then because we didn't have relations with Poland at the time, and Poland was really completely in a shambles, the Americans ended up taking Vitez back to the United States, where he was sent to California. And the Army had a ranch in California that had been donated by Kellogg of the Kellogg Cereal Fortune, who was an Arabian horse breeding aficionado. And Vitez was sent to that Army base. But the Army base was eventually closed, and so Vitez ended up, after much, I think this is maybe three, four years after he was brought to the United States, to great fanfare, he actually ended up on an auction block being sold off to the highest bidder, because the Army had permanently closed down their horse breeding program, and that was it. They sold off the horses that were left. And so it was to me, that was just very, very sad to think that that's what happened. And yet, Vitez ended up having a really beautiful story, because he was bought into private hands to a man who truly loved and appreciated the horse. And he became one of the most prominent sires of Arabian horses in the United States. Many, I've received many letters from people who've read the book and can tell me that their own horses trace back, that they have Vitez in their lineage. And so he lived out his life in peace, and really had a big impact in his adopted home of the United States.
He lived happily ever after. What else can we say? That's a great way to end our conversation, Elizabeth. This has just been really special to have you on the show and to enjoy your book. There's so much we haven't covered, the whole European side of this and the cast of characters that made this all happen. I glossed over that way too quickly, but that's in the interest of the time. That's the reason why we urge our listeners to read these books. And this one is The Perfect Horse. And it's The Daring U.S. Mission to Rescue the Priceless Stallions Kidnapped by the Nazis, by Elizabeth Letts. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Next week, Saladin Ambar, author of Malcolm X at Oxford Union, Racial Politics in a Global Era. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Samantha Wright. Our producer is Janelle Brown. Research by Brady Moore. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find out more about our program, including links to previous interviews and what's coming up next, on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.